Morning. Welcome to our worship service today at Theodore Parker Church. I'm Robin Colgrove, the chairman of the Music and Worship Committee, and my family's been coming to this church for, 15, 16 years or so. We're delighted that you're here visiting with us. If you're visiting for the first time, we extend a special welcome to you. Our congregation dates back now 300 years and comes from all sorts of traditions from all over the place, and we welcome you no matter where you are on your own spiritual journey. In the pew in front of you, there should be welcome packets. If you're interested in learning more about the church, just fill out the form there, and we'll get back to you. Please join us after the service for coffee hour. It's through the breezeway there in the parish hall. And there'll be a membership table for anybody who's interested in learning more about the church. We have a special service today. Dr. Booker Bush will be our guest minister, and we look forward to hearing what he has to say about collard greens and quiche. Okay. There are announcements in your leaflet. Please take a minute to look at those announcements. Are there any other announcements from the congregation, Tori?
These opening words are from Adam Gopnik. I don't understand how a young couple can begin life by buying a sofa or a television. Don't they know the table comes first? The table comes first before the meal and even before the kitchen when it's made. It precedes everything in remaining the one plausible hearth of family life, the raft to ride down the river of our existence, even in the hardest of times. The table also comes first in the sense of drama. The people who gather at it, the conversation that flows across it, and the pain and romance that happen around it. It is more essential to our real lives, and also the real life of food in the world, than any number of arguments about where the zucchini came from and how far it had to travel before it got here. If our questions of food matter, it's because they imply the big fights about who we are, our notions of clan and nation, identity, and the individual. If our questions of food are to hold out the promise of self-knowledge that gastronomy once offered, we can't ask them outside of history. Welcome to our table here. Our first hymn is number 38. It is Morning Has Broken. I don't know if this is your tradition, but rise if you're willing and able.
Hi, my name is Eli, if you don't know, and our ritual last week was not to be nice to everybody, so for that to happen, you would have to not be stressed, and this is our ritual for not being stressed. So I have my little presenter here, Jasper, and we are going to show you our ritual for not being stressed. So we found that rubbing your hands for a little while would help get out the stress. My hands are cold. And so after you should deep breathe while doing that for 20 seconds. And then you can say out loud or in your head, it's all right, because you've gotten out the stress. So let's try it. It's all right. So, we light this chalice for shared ritual,
for the spaces we share and open to each other, for the construction of each of our own ritual railings, the railings that connect us to each other, that connect us to our faith. Now the children can follow me. Now that we're all relaxed, it is my great pleasure for me to introduce our guest speaker this morning, Dr. Booker Bush. Let me begin by saying that Booker is my friend. He is also the husband of my friend and colleague, the Reverend Janet Bush, who is the minister of our congregation in Northampton. And for a number of years, when I was the minister of the church, Booker was the chair of the Music and Worship Committee of the UU Society in Wellesley Hills. Booker has a very impressive resume as a physician and academic, but to me, he will always be the very best cook of all of my friends. He is a committed Unitarian Universalist. He sings tenor in his choir. He serves currently as a coming-of-age mentor, and he is an excellent preacher, and I am delighted that he is here with us this morning.
So I'm the chair of Music and Worship Committee here, and at a recent meeting, Phyllis said that she had somebody that she knew who could do a guest service, and his name was Booker Bush. And I thought, how many Booker Bushes can there be in Massachusetts? Because when I was an intern many years ago, we came out from San Francisco thinking we would spend a couple of years in New England and then go back to California. And I came out to the House of God, the Beth Israel Hospital, to be an intern. And one of my attendings there was one Dr. Booker Bush. And at the time, I'm not the most psychologically stable person in the best of time, but if you imagine adding on to that stress and sleep deprivation, I was, marginally controlled intern. And I was very fortunate to have some much more calm and together physician attendings to help train me. And one of them that I would never have forgotten was Booker Bush. I don't think we've seen one another since, 92 or so. And so it's a delight to have him back. I had no idea there was any Unitarian connection. At the time, I considered myself an escaped Catholic, and I didn't even know I was a Unitarian. I had always been a Unitarian. And it would be several years later when I'd actually discover that. So it's a delight to have him back. And, of course, as you know, in this congregation, I have the reputation of cooking exotic and interesting things, and I had no idea that there was this connection with cooking as well. I wish I had time to I knew the sermon was about collard greens and quiche, and I've been thinking about collard quiche. Can I do something with that? I'm afraid I didn't have time to make a recipe. So for coffee hour today, I just made the classic Theodore Parker bean dips, but that'll be there for you. Anyway, I'm delighted that Booker's here. Have our first reading. From the Unprejudiced Palate by Anthony Pellegrini, 1948. The emphasis I have placed on food and drink may need some elucidation. The cuisine may be generally regarded as a part of people's culture, the quality of the fare, the manner in which it is prepared, the time devoted to its ingestion, the conventions of the dinner table. These are intimately related to and frequently reflect a people's aesthetic development. The Europeans and the Asiatics had developed their traditional cuisine by utilizing to the highest possible degree the resources peculiar to their time and place. Across the centuries and by imperceptible degrees, they have made it an integral part of their culture. The American, lacking the spur of necessity and engrossed in the exploitation of resources with which no other nation has been so blessed in anything like the same degree, has been understandably satisfied to feed on plain meat and potatoes. His curiosity about culinary matters of relatively recent origin is an encouraging sign. If he would proceed wisely, however, he must remember that the evolution of a traditional cuisine requires time. His immediate concern should be a willingness to experiment, an insistence upon quality, a purging of his mind of all culinary prejudices, and the development of a humane attitude toward the dinner hour. These are not the slavish imitation of foreign recipes and esoteric menus. These are the basis upon which a sound American cuisine may be eventually developed. He must guard himself against a danger to which he is predisposed by his aesthetic naivete, the tendency to be easily impressed by cults and coteries of foreign descent. Their insistence that cooking is an art and eating and drinking are a ritual has thrown the dinner hour out of focus and produced needless confusion. There are few Americans, for example, who can serve a dinner that deviates a little from the native tradition without being somewhat self-conscious about it. And who is certain about when to serve red and when to serve white wine? The proper attitude, of course, is that it doesn't make a damn bit of difference. So ends the reading. Now at this point in the service, we will gratefully receive your offerings to continue the good works of this church. So as you know, we've had a tradition in this church of having an offertory dedication. For many years, we've sung Spirit of Truth to the tune of Mendon, and we'll go around in this. And recently, we've been singing it to the tune of The Water is Wide. And last week, Michael Johnson wrote a lovely Semitic scale version of this. Today, we'll do my version of this that I wrote a couple years ago. I'll sing it once through, and then we'll go through twice. At the congregation. Most of you know it already.
Let's spend a moment or two meditating and thinking. And if it works for you, you can wring your hands together for 20 seconds. I'd like you to think about who you've enjoyed sitting at the table with. I'd like you to think about who would you like to share the table with sometime in the future. I'd like you to think about the best meals you've had. I'd like you to think about painful meals you've shared together. I'd like you to think about people you can no longer share the table with. All of the other readings I'll talk about more when I do this sermon. This reading, which is by Francine Prose from a book called Gluttony, there's a series of books done to illustrate the seven deadly sins. This reading is just to give me balance, or give balance to everything else I'm going to say, which is that food is like the most wonderful thing in the world. Aquinas would say that an inordinate desire is a one that makes you depart from the path of reason, which is the regulator and guarantee of moral value. Pardon me, of moral virtue. In any case, the novice overeater can relax, because if one overindulges through inexperience, because of a hazy or otherwise inaccurate idea of how much food is necessary, that is not gluttony. It is a case of gluttony only when a man knowingly exceeds the measure in eating from a desire for the pleasure of the palate. And Aquinas returns to the notion that the sinfulness of gluttony lies in its ability to distract man from the final end, and from the love of and the pure dedication to God. The specter of gluttony was never to prevent the faithful from eating. The early Christian theologians had a surprisingly tolerant attitude toward the occasional overindulgence. The sin of gluttony was one of degree, but the degree that appeared to matter most was not so much excessive consumption as excessive appetite, desire, and attention. The fixation on food, the pleasures derived from taste, the self-inflicted pain of starvation, and especially the ways in which all these related fixations turned one's attention away from the more important and urgent needs of the soul and the spirit. Too soon, too delicately, too expensively, too greedily, too much. If we use this yardstick together with the excessive preoccupation and inordinate interest to identify the sin and the sinner, it becomes obvious that though gluttony appears to have become the least harmful of sins, it may well be the most widespread. Precisely because of our inordinate interests, our preoccupation with sampling the trendiest dishes at the costliest new restaurants, and our apparently paradoxical obsessive horror of obesity, we have become a culture of gluttons. Our next hymn in the gray hymnal is "We Sing Now Together." Please rise if you are willing and able.
Demanding their deeds have made immortal their days. pledge ourselves in covenant for thee to stand.
How many of you had to sing that at Thanksgiving? I'm not going to start quite yet. As some of you know, well, maybe as you figured out, how did I get here? I was really happy teaching and working at Beth Israel. I was there from 1981 until 2010 as a primary care doctor, and I really, really enjoyed it. The reason I left is because my wife became a Unitarian minister about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago. And I'm not going to talk about this now, but the reason she became a UU minister is because of Phyllis. Phyllis called her at a certain point and said, "Have you ever thought of becoming a minister?" And then she decided to do that. And she's really good at it, and I really enjoy it. And she's now in her first pulpit at UU Northampton in Florence. But because of that, I had to leave my very pleasant practice at BI and teaching marvelous doctors like Robin. And I missed that immensely. That's a whole nother sermon that if you invited me back, I'd be glad to talk with you about. So now I'll, and by the way, and because now I'm in Northampton, and I wrote this sermon originally for people in Northampton. Northampton, if you visit there, sits in the middle of farms. And so one of the pleasures I have is that you know, when I was around here, I was going to Allendale Farm every now and then to buy stuff. But there, almost everything is grown within about a mile or two from where you live, if you choose to eat that way. And so that's a big deal to me. But now I'll start in earnest. Back in the 70s, while Janet, my wife, was in business school, so she's been through a lot of careers, there were a number of international students who organized a potluck dinner. And they asked that all the participants bring a dish that reflected their country of their heritage. I was already interested in food, and at that time I was the cook, and I still am, for our household. So what should I make? Should I make an iconic American dish or a dish from my African-American upbringing? I made a quiche. I used the recipe from Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Eggs, cream, bacon. You boil the bacon first to remove that American smokiness from it. Gruyere cheese, which is from Switzerland, all set in a pastry dough done in the French fashion, which only includes butter, flour, and water. Quiche. What was that about? I grew up in Berkeley, California. My father having moved there from Georgia by way of Tuskegee, and my mother was from Louisiana. My mother did all the cooking, though I believe what she cooked was strongly influenced by what my father wished to have. The memorable dinners for me were beef stew with potatoes and carrots and peas, Sunday dinners with ham, mashed sweet potatoes on pineapple rings that are finished in the oven with a marshmallow on top, served with green beans. Actually, there was also a maraschino cherry on top, but I leave that out in case there are kids still in the... Once a month, my father cooked over a barbecue pit, cooking pork spare ribs after making his own sauce. Lots of ketchup, brown sugar, vinegar, lemons, whole lemons. And based on who was coming over, different amounts of Tabasco. These were bigger extended family events with many aunts and uncles and many cousins. There were potato salads, usually three kinds, made by my mother and different aunts. Green beans cooked in the southern fashion, and I'm going to have a lot to say about what that means. And then dessert, which includes peach cobblers, sweet potato pies, lemon custard pies, and vanilla wafer crusts. Yeah, can you taste home?
But at least twice a week, there were meals that were difficult for me. Those would include chitlins, collard greens cooked with ham hocks, cornbread, not with sugar the way you New Englanders like it, and fried catfish. I didn't know the chitlins were made from pig intestines, but I knew what they smelled like when they were being cooked. They smelt like whatever you imagined foul-smelling intestines would smell like when they were cooking. It was difficult to even walk into the house. I never ate chitlins until I was at Yale. And the master of our house, Dick Goldsby, African-American biologist, made chitlins for the night before the Harvard-Yale game. And he cooked them in his hood in the biology lab. Back to the sermon. I ate beets as a kid. They were from a jar. But I exclusively ate them because if you put enough of them on top of greens, you couldn't taste the greens. I did not have friends over for collard greens. If a friend came over for lunch, it was likely to be a ham sandwich or a hamburger. It also might be a tuna sandwich. I grew up Catholic, too, Robin. When you were a child, did you like tuna salad sandwiches? Did you still like them when you went to somebody else's house for lunch? Yeah, I see. Every house has their own tuna salad. And one of the most difficult things to do was to act like you actually liked somebody else's tuna salad. This isn't about salt. It's about how much mayo is blended in. Is there celery in it? What brand of tuna? For me, and I imagine some of you, there was only one kind of tuna salad. It's what your mother made. For some of us, there may still be only one kind of tuna salad. Can you taste home? When I left home for college, I ate whatever the dining hall offered. Lots of baked chicken, pasta with sauce. By the way, that's the way you're supposed to do pasta. You put the sauce on top, sort of the way that the Italians did it. In a black home, pasta and sauce were baked together with lots of cheese. And I'm not talking about lasagna. It was spaghetti noodles, tomato sauce, ground beef, cheddar cheese, put into a pan and baked. I discovered some new foods that my classmates were used to as home dishes, the most memorable of which was bagels, lox, and cream cheese, which I'd never had until college. My mother cooked based on what she was taught, not by recipe. Greens and string beans were cooked in the same fashion. Many hours in a pot, hours in a pot, with a ham hock or a ham bone until very soft, and the cooking liquid became part of the dish. You could smell whatever it was, the green beans or the collard greens or the ham hocks cooking, and the house was totally filled with the odor. To me, a string bean can cook for 5 to 10 minutes in rapidly boiling salted water, then served. If I'm serving guests, after cooking, I drop them into very cold water because that locks the color green. Then you reheat the beans with a little bit of olive oil. Collard greens or chard or mustard greens or spinach can be cooked for a minute or two in rapidly boiling water, iced so that the green color is held, then reheated in olive oil that is flavored with a clove or two of garlic. In both of these techniques, the house doesn't smell like home. The dish is pretty, and the person at table can comment on the colors and how now they note they're hungry. When you lean over the plate, you can smell the dish. Any of you seen the movie Ratatouille? Favorite.
The penultimate scene is the ratatouille, when the ratatouille is served. Ratatouille is a peasant dish. Do you remember the scene in the movie? So, do you know who was the consultant cook? It was Thomas Keller from the French Laundry, probably the cook in the world, in the United States. So when he prepared the ratatouille, it wasn't done in the way I bet all of you cook ratatouille, or the way I cook ratatouille. He sliced the zucchinis and the squashes and the eggplant very thinly, laid them out in a casserole dish. They were baked. Then they were presented by wrapping each thing over each. So when they were presented to the critic, the evil critic, it was this stunningly beautiful presentation. It was a Thomas Keller presentation. And then when he takes the taste, he's immediately taken back to being an 8 or 9 year old crying with a bowl of mushed together ratatouille. It's a great scene. It's a phenomenal scene. Now when you go back and watch the movie again, watch the presentation of the dish. In my mother's house, you became hungry as soon as you entered the house, because the house smelt like green beans and ham hocks. You could taste home. When I visited my grandparents in Georgia, dishes were prepared the exact same way my mother cooked them. You walked into the house, and amongst the odors, not like my house in Berkeley, but there were familiar odors, green beans, sweet potato pies. When I walked into my grandparents' house in Barnesville, Georgia, I knew I was home. Southern cooking is to some extent African-American cooking. Africans brought as slaves, did much of the work in the fields, but they also served as the cooks in the kitchens, which at the times were dangerous places. Large pots held by large hooks over fires in very hot, uncomfortable places. Many of the dishes that became staples of Southern cuisine actually had their roots in Africa. The yam and its distant cousin, the sweet potato, corn ground into hominy and fried into quick cakes, or baked into cornbread, and green vegetables that were stewed for long periods of time so that you could live on the greens if you were lucky, or just drink the broth if you weren't. It was not home, but it could at least smell like home. So what is soul food? What Lou Rawls was singing about. I'll see if Lou Rawls ever makes an appearance here in your sanctuary again. Isn't this a place where we should at least think about what is part of the soul? I couldn't say that in Northampton, by the way. So what is soul food? Jessica Harris, who's a writer who specializes in African-American cuisine, writes that soul food is the food of the South that has been served in black homes and restaurants around the country. But there's disagreement amongst us on what that food was. Is it the food, as she writes, of the plantation South that was fed to the enslaved, a diet of hog and hominy supplemented by what could be foraged or stolen to relieve the monotony? Was it the fried chicken served by those who hawked wares at train stations in Virginia or packed it in boxes for those who were migrating to Kansas? During the 60s, along with the rise of the Black Power movement, there came to be traditional African-American cookbooks. And they were talking about the virtues of greens, macaroni and cheese, neck bones, chitlins, and fried chicken. By the end of the decade and through the 70s, partially related to health issues, also due to the influence of the Nation of Islam, brown rice, smoked turkey wings, tahini, and tofu, also on urban African-American tables as a sign of protest against what was the enslaved diet. During the 70s, and I think even now, you were what you ate. Food is politics. Members of the Nation of Islam were recognized by their suits and bow ties, but also by their diet, which was without any hint of pork. It was the food given to the enslaved by the masters. The Nation of Islam had many stores and restaurants, if you were in an African-American neighborhood, and there were some in Roxbury, where you could eat more properly and well, and they did keep the traditional African-American profile, sugary desserts and well-cooked vegetables. So what about the quiche? I was part of the upwardly mobile bourgeoisie which discovered Julia Child, Graham Kerr, James Beard, beef bourguignon, cheese fondue, and quiche. Soul food was for family get-togethers and reunions, places where as soon as you walked into the house, church hall, or backyard, you could immediately smell home. Quiche was my identity at that time, though I actually still cringe about it now. To be African American at that time was partially what you ate and whom you ate it with. To like food made in a French style was not about taste, it's partially about who you were and what you aspired to be. The first reading that Robin read is by Anthony Pellegrini. He was born in 1911 in Italy in poverty. His father left Italy and came to America to find a new life. He brought Anthony and the rest of the family in 1922 to the Pacific Northwest, and he found a land of great abundance. The book, which I highly recommend, it's called An Unprejudiced Palate, describes how he ate in Italy and how he feasted in America, living by foraging, growing his own vegetables, making his own wine, and discovering America's greatest culinary contribution to the world, which was bacon, eggs, hash browns, and a toast for breakfast. He said, by the way, don't put ketchup on it. Breakfast smells like home. He was amazed that we all liked bread that stuck to the roof of our mouths. Unripe fruit from supermarkets, and foods cooked without herbs. Garlic, he said, was simply waved over a dish, rather than including entire heads of garlic. Cheese was this yellow, tasteless stuff. His cooking, by the way, Pellegrini's, was not that different from Southern tradition. However, he said the ingredients should be fresh, grown close by, not for environmental or organic reasons. By the way, this is written in 1948, so those words weren't in play yet. Instead, we should do it for taste. Tomato sauces would simmer for hours. A vegetable such as beans tasted better if done in the pan along with the meat you were planning to serve. Why not let them marry together for 30 or 40 minutes? The kitchen will smell and the stomach will growl. By the way, I found it, my favorite cook is Alice Waters from Berkeley, who really has revolutionized, made us think about organic and local food. She said the way she learned her philosophy was by reading Pellegrini. And that's why his book has come back out again. Pellegrini, like my ancestors, immigrated here. He also found prejudice against Italians when he arrived. Although similar, it was different. He went from poverty to abundance. My ancestors went from freedom to slavery. However, all discovered that vegetables cooked with love could evoke comfort. It could, if it wasn't home, it could at least smell like home. His book was published in 1948, discovered years later by some people interested in food in Berkeley, the leader of which was Alice Waters. Because of her theology about cooking, much of our approach is now, frankly, quite different. Grow your own food, or buy it from somebody nearby. It should be organic. It should be sustainably produced. Get the best quality you can afford. Prepare it simply but thoughtfully. Cook at home. Eat around the table. Talk to each other. Inhale the smells. Make the smells home. What do the French know that we don't? We think they know so much more about food than we do. Pellegrini warned us not to be taken in by the foreigners who know more than we do. Julia Child brought us their technique. Many have refined it to use more of our own produce. Alice Waters certainly brings a Southern French aesthetic to cooking. We're also stealing from the Italians, the Chinese, and the Japanese. Here's what I take away. The French, the Italians, the Japanese pay attention to what they are eating and how it is cooked. They pay attention. We, I think, are now paying attention. It's like paying attention to sunsets. It's like paying attention to sunrises, birdsong, full moons. Pay attention to smells. Pay attention to home. I love to cook. I love to eat. I love to cook for family and friends. I'm already missing the fact that Phyllis can't come over as much as she used to. I love to caramelize onions. The sugary taste and odor make the kitchen a heavenly place. Garlic roasting in an oven or a tomato sauce, they transform the house. So what would I make for that potluck event now? It would be a tart. The dough made from butter, water, and flour. The filling would be collard greens, quickly boiled and iced to lock in the green color. I would then sprinkle on roasted onions, goat cheese, and roasted garlic. Then enough cream combined with egg to bind everything, baked for 40 minutes. I just made this last Friday. We're welcoming the new congregational minister to Northampton and Jen, and I just had he and his wife over, and this is what I made. When you walk in the door, you smell the onions, the garlic, and the butter. It smells wonderful, and you're hungry. It's about home, my past, my present. It's local. I grow collard greens in my backyard now. It's done with love, and it smells great. Our next hymn, our final hymn, is number 205, also my request, Amazing Grace. Please rise as you are willing and able.
Thank you.
been a real pleasure for me to be here. Thank you. May you all find tables to eat at tonight. May those who don't have tables find tables in their future. May each of us offer empty spaces at our tables for those who don't have tables. May we all enjoy the smells of home.
Thank you. And I finished my mortgage in the city.